too windy today.
No, it's Thursday.
So am I. Let's go have a drink. Welcome to Brookings Cafe. There's just no telling who might be here today as we venture in to quench our thirst. We call it our Great American Debate. We come to the discussion in the spirit of fairness and an attempt to offer something conclusive. We don't claim to be experts, but we will strive to come to the table prepared to discuss our topic. We are going to extend invitations to those we think may offer an opposing point of view, and in some cases we may extend a challenge to specific people or groups to defend their point of view. Beware, we fact-check anything that sounds questionable, and we look dimly on mere opinions that aren't based in knowledge. We are trying to reach some sort of a resolution, something that both sides can settle on as an idea worth promoting.
All right, my name is Ray Gary, and today on Brookings Cafe, we're going to be talking to Scott Thiemann, who's with the Master Gardeners Program. And we also have Dan Sherman here as a co-host. Scott is going to tell you a little bit about himself, because I don't know anything about him, and that way he would know more about him and what he does than I do. So we'll turn it over to you, Scott.
Great, thank you very much. Yes, my name is Scott Thiemann, and I presently work as the Master Gardener Coordinator for Curry County through OSU Extension, which is located on the fairgrounds in Gold Beach. And we have our office there for all of our extension positions here in Curry County. We also run training for master gardeners. That's where we really get our volunteers yearly. And that's one thing I definitely want to talk about to everybody. We do that usually mid-January to mid-March, 10-week course. And, you know, we could talk a little bit about gardening, and I can share some with you about what I learned about invasive plants today at a meeting that I went to, which was very interesting. There were about 25 people from throughout Coos and Curry counties gathered together, in Douglas even, to try to figure out strategies on eradicating certain weeds, especially before they get a foothold in the county.
This is the only place I've ever lived where we have a pretty invasive plant, that Scotch broom. It's kind of almost a shame to cut those down.
Well, the problem is that they're taking the place of other plants, and they just don't really belong here. That being said, there are certain plants that this environment accommodates very well. It's a mild climate, and a lot of things grow here that grow well in many other parts of the world. But what happens is they don't have, like, natural pests, right, or diseases that take them out.
Now, so, I was walking the other day on a trail, and I think I saw a deer eating one. Do they ever eat them? I've been told that nothing eats them. It just had its head off in the bush. Maybe it was eating something else. But
hard to say. Deer are noted for trying all sorts of things, especially maybe if they're young.
It didn't eat for very long, so maybe it was just trying.
Could have been.
One of the problems with those is they're incredibly flammable, too. I was burning some brush that I'd cut down last year, just stuff that had been piled up and was dry. And when I threw some of the other stuff on it, it just kind of burned. And then I threw some Scotch broom on it, and it, like, exploded. It was really very flammable. I'm told there's a lot of oil in them.
It looks like you had the evidence right there in front of you. I know that, you know, Bandon burned because of a relative, gorse, which is one of the major problems, both North and South County. And it, you know, it's that caused a huge fire that I don't remember if people perished or not, but definitely a huge amount of town.
They're the
burned.
Ones that introduced it to Oregon, aren't they? Didn't they bring it here for some kind of?
Could have been, yeah. Usually when people bring plants from their homeland or their seeds. And an issue with gorse and broom, it's very interesting. Issue with gorse and broom is that the seeds are viable for years and years and years. I mean, we're talking 60, 70 years. So once you get those into the soil, it's especially hard to eradicate.
You're talking about invasive plants, and I'm from Oklahoma. There we have kudzu is starting to sneak in.
Wow.
And that stuff is incredibly invasive, particularly in the South. I remember touring in the South some years back and seeing kudzu that had covered over entire barns and was wiping out stands of trees because it could overtake the trees. And do we have anything like that here? Is that what you're talking about?
Kudzu is an interesting thing. What I was reading about, I think it was National Geographic or something, it's people have maybe overrated how damaging it is, in the sense that it really does need, often gets started by roadsides, which a lot of invasive plants do, mm-hmm. because they're carried by, especially by vehicles and that kind of thing, or, you know, wind, and they're often disturbed areas. Highway areas are open, tend to be more open. So that's the biggest danger, I'd say, for that's where you'll see, and they're so visible here in Curry, you'll see so many invasive plants because of that issue. Now, I'd also heard that someone was trying to grow kudzu here, and I can't remember the story, but I think they incurred a major fine. So don't bring kudzu in.
Oh, no, I'm not planning to bring any in. But
No, but it was funny because you're talking about Oklahoma. But, I mean, again, with such a forgiving climate as we have here, we have more issues.
Why would they want to bring kudzu in?
Because they think it's a cool plant. It's a neat vine. And that's the problem. People see plants.
But it can bury your house. I've seen whole buildings engulfed with kudzu.
Yeah.
Cars. And
yeah.
Yeah, you have to keep those things fired up and running, you know.
Yeah. I have almost as bad a problem, I think, with blackberries.
Yes, you do. I was going to say, that's your kudzu. That's an Oregon coastal kudzu.
I understand equivalent. There's two different kinds of blackberries here. There's one that's kind of a vine, and then there's one that's more of a stick, or whatever you want to call it.
There's more, probably even more than that.
Well, really?
There's definitely the runner type, the native, which are the ones you trip over.
Yeah.
You know, that are thin vines generally. Whereas Himalayan grows every which way, and it will find sun too. I mean, I've seen it coming up between in a dark space between trees. It just, you know, shoots for the sun. So it can vine up as well. I mean, that mm-hmm. stuff can get 30 feet high.
I was really enjoying a few weeks ago when the blackberries were fairly thick where I am. And I walk in the morning, and I was there are logging roads behind my house, and I was enjoying eating handfuls of blackberries until my wife reminded me about the strawberries we used to have in Alaska, and when she'd put them in a bowl in a few minutes, there'd be all kinds of bugs crawling out. And she said, the blackberries here are just as bad. They have worms and bugs in them too. But I didn't know it at the time, but I haven't eaten any blackberries right off the vine since.
Hmm. Yeah, because I know lots of people who do. They just snag them off the vine, bugs what have you. I mean, I don't think you're in any danger like the guy who ate the slug on a dare and paralyzed and then died.
Oh. You know,
there are lots of things I don't think you should be eating.
Well, I don't think the bugs actually do me any harm. Just the idea of eating a maggot doesn't really do anything.
That's what paralyzed, huh?
Yeah. Beneficial bugs.
Maybe it's just me, but...
Well, one of the things that I know about Oregon is that the growing season is longer here than it is in Oklahoma. And that was what I found incredible when I toured Alaska several years ago, was that because it's daylight so long there, I mean, these, you know, lettuces that are huge.
Yeah.
And you can't grow them that way, you know, down south anywhere. Yeah,
things explode there. But where I lived anyway, the soil was so awful, it was very specific to growing the things that have evolved to grow there. Hmm. And whenever we tried to plant anything, it didn't work.
Yeah. But so does the longer growing season here, is that something that fuels the invasive species even more?
Sure. Yeah, that would definitely be part of it. It's interesting. I had something to share about that because I think the climate is very, has a lot to do with how these things transplant mm-hmm. and translate into other areas. And when I lived in New Zealand, there were a couple plants there that you'll see here that, now can I remember top of my head? That one's a vine, jasmine. And it was the one that really vined. It has the pretty like reddish buds before, you know, the white flowers, really nice smell. And it tends to be more of a vine. Well, there it really does. And it would grow up in really shady situations that were quite surprising to find that you would see it in their forest. So it's invasive there, where I've never seen anything like that here. And then what's the one with the onion-like flower, round head? I want to say it begins with an H. I always forget the words or the names, but it's got broad. It's a perennial, kind of long, narrow, roundish leaves at the tip, and purplish blue round flowers, and it also naturalizes there. In fact, it just like comes out in the middle of the freeway. But you don't see that here, although I've seen places where it's starting to seem like it might have that possibility. And it's, you know, you're depending where you're at, the conditions make a huge difference as far as, and maybe it's extra moisture, maybe it's moisture being spread out over the year more than it is here, like we have, you know, the real dry season in the mm-hmm. summer. You know, so it just depends on how, and the soil type. I mean, you know, there's just so many things that affect variables that affect how things
can grow. I have a question about soil type. Most of the soil on my property is awful. It's the land was terraced in order to put houses on. It was a very thick slope. So when I'm not dealing with topsoil at all. So when I plant a bush, I enrich the soil that's there with 50% of potting soil.
And what happens
when it gets out of that little hole? Is it able to?
Well, that's why you want to mix. It's surprising what will grow here once you get it in the ground.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of that has to do with mixing that soil, the native soil, with nicer potting soil. You don't want, especially if you have really hard clay soil, you don't want to dig a hole and just fill it with potting soil and then put the plant in, because it's almost like you're creating a pot. And then the roots will reach mm-hmm. the end of their growing area that's really that beautiful, rich soil.
Yeah.
And then they won't take. I mean, it won't want to go any further.
So are they adapting to the mixed soil in it?
I think it helps, yeah. Oh, okay. I mean, you know, and you just have to watch it. Most plants, again, are very forgiving and will do pretty well here.
This is an incredibly good place to do that. Yeah. I lived in Tucson for a while, and I get about 30% survival on whatever I planted, it seemed like. But here, things grow like crazy.
Yeah.
One thing I would like to point out real quick, for those who are listening, if you hear this tap, tap, tapping sound, please don't become alarmed. They're in the middle of doing construction around the building around us.
And I thought they were nailing the door shut to keep us in. No.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I want to know more about the invasive species. How many of these are we talking about? Are we just talking about a couple of them, or are we talking about 30 or 40?
Yeah, I'd say we're talking about that many, upwards to that many. The ones that are really getting a foothold here, and they put them in three levels. They were talking about that again, or they kind of classify them by three levels for curry. I mean, it could be different in different counties again. Mm-hmm. The ones that we really want to target and get rid of because they haven't got a foothold here. I think there's this thing called critical mass. That's the term I use anyhow, where you just reach that tipping point where you'll have a plant and then all of a sudden it gets really happy and it's reproducing and you have all sorts of seeds spread by birds, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. A good example right now of one that may not even be on that top list, but I think is one of our worst, is Cotoneaster. And it's a beautiful plant. If you look at the plants, the strawberry trees, the miniature ones, I believe they are, by the library. Mm-hmm. You get an idea. I'm trying to think of where and I know they're around. The Cotoneasters I'm thinking of, they have the larger green leaf, and they have all the red berries right now. Mm-hmm. And the birds love those, and they spread them. So they've become a real issue. They can be trained in like a multi-branch tree, but I really can't recommend those anymore because of the damage they're doing as far as getting transplanted out into the native areas. You know, people ask me all the time about their landscaping, and what I'd suggest is that, you know, some of these things you can grow in the city, but manage them. If you're going to pick a plant, that also means take care of it for your neighbors. Mm-hmm. You know, that means manage it in a way where it's not going to become a problem. And especially if you live out more in the hinterlands or you have large acreage, you really want to be careful what you're growing in those areas, because you're, you know, right next to a bunch of native plants and forestry land that it could be very susceptible to something like this.
My wife and I argue about pampas grass. I love it. And she doesn't mind it, but she just said, you know, she lived in California where it took over whole beaches and whatever. I have some on my property. I'm actually seeding to put some in a newly cleared area. What do you think of pampas grass?
Don't do that.
No.
That would be one of the ones on that top list that we'd say we really want to get rid of. And what's happening is this, and if you're seeding, I think, and this is where I'm not exactly sure because I saw pampas grass in the book I was looking at today, but it's actually called Jabuta grass. And it's a little bit, it's not as vigorous, maybe not quite as tall or staunch, can't think of the word, a plant. And that's the one that you see that's been spreading up from California and now has entered Oregon. And I mean, it's, I guess it's all the way up the coast or a long way up the coast now. Mm-hmm. It's spreading, and you know, it could be partly due to a warmer climate that we're seeing some of these things spread even more. So that's one, and it is a nice looking plant in the right place, you know, in Argentina, it's great. But anyhow, that's one that I would not encourage, and I can understand why you would want to choose that. And you know, that one is, if it's pampas grass, I'm not so sure it's going to spread, but again, like I said, that was in the booklet that I had. So there's a fellow who's doing some DNA test, I found out, on that stuff today. He's going all the way up the coast to where it's been spread, I guess right into Washington, and seeing how that compares to how they compare to each other and what maybe the native stock was or something, mm-hmm. which is really fascinating. I'm looking forward to reading that report when I get it.
Hmm. Yeah, this kind of reminded me of Johnson grass, which we have a lot of in Oklahoma. And I went to visit Hawaii several years ago and discovered that they brought in Johnson grass because they wanted to bring in cattle. And for some reason, somebody thought that Johnson grass would be good food for cows. And as it turns out, they don't eat it because it's nasty stuff. And it is. It really is. It takes over a lot of things.
When I lived in Tucson, I used to hike on some open range, and I saw cattle eating prickly pear cactus.
Oh, well, that's different. This isn't Johnson grass. We're talking
okay.
about Johnson grass.
But I think that's anyway, there as well.
So this is an invasive species yeah. for Hawaii, and it's taken over the countryside, and apparently they have no way of getting rid of it. And so that's kind of my question, is you're talking about getting rid of things like Johnson grass, et cetera, but how do you do that?
Well, you know, you're either going to have to use a chemical solution or you're going to have to hand dig it out.
Mm-hmm. Which brings me to, tell us about chemical solutions. I know there's one that you probably don't even want to say the name of. It makes wood, company.
Yeah.
But what's a good one and what?
For woody shrubs, I always get to say this wrong. Triclopyr and 2,4-D are, and I don't really want to give the name of the product, but they're available. Because I'm not here to advertise for anybody.
So is that safer than the R word? Isn't that the main ingredient?
That's glyphosate you're thinking
of. Oh, okay.
Okay, and that's the one more used for herbaceous plants. It's not that it won't kill woody plants, and sometimes in tandem, like for berries, they could be mixed together, you know, and that would be a way to have better results, get better results than by just using them individually. But you have to really be careful too. You know, you want to do your research first. You don't want to just go out and experiment and throw things together, because together might not be a good idea as far the poison or the chemicals that are involved.
What about prine? I understand that's very safe. Prime? You're not familiar with it? This is something you put on the ground before plants start to sprout, or if you get them within, I think it's 2 inches, it will kill them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know what you're saying.
But it won't kill
preen.
An existing.
You're talking about preen.
Preen, okay.
Yeah, yeah. There are those things, and Casseron is another one where, again, I shouldn't be saying the names because I'm not here to advertise, but they'll have a chemical compound that will keep pre-emerging weeds.
And are they safe to use, or are they?
Well, they're, yeah. I mean, if anything's on the market and it's available to you, it should be.
Okay.
And I think all of those are listed in Department of Agriculture, Oregon Department of Agriculture, like on the website as far as, you know. And also we have what we call the Oregon State University Pacific Northwest pesticide guide for guides that are part of both like plant diseases and also for insects. But it's better to go online or to call us, which people are welcome to do, and we'll try to do the research and find out and send them links to how to handle those kind of things. There's a lot of, I'm not really good at, and I don't want to be in some ways, to be honest with you, at throwing out, especially when it comes to chemicals, what they are. I really want to look it up before I make any recommendations. And that's the same with our master gardeners who are volunteers. We run a plant clinic, and that's one of the things we do is we try to answer people's questions regarding plant issues that they have and, you know, give them researched information, especially from OSU that we have available. But it might be from UC Davis or it might be from Washington State, different universities, especially with extension programs.
Yeah. So now if we're talking about putting chemicals or digging it up as a control method, that's probably fine if you're talking about a small area like my yard. But are these plants in danger of essentially hopping the coastal range and heading on into Eugene?
Some are. Yeah, it just depends on, you know, their adaptability to those environments.
Yeah.
And how easily they can spread. You know, there's one that people love, and it's been kind of on that list for a long time. It's called butterfly bush, and I'm trying to remember. I've been away. I used to start out, I didn't say this when I introduced myself, but I did landscaping here in the county for about 10 years, and as well as up in Portland, Seattle area. And, you know, I really, and through the Master Gardener program, actually, I learned a lot about the plants and what really worked here, as well as, of course, just visiting nurseries and seeing what's available. But anyhow, I was going somewhere with that that information about, I think, just so as far as remembering like the botanical name, which is the safest way to go, because sometimes common names will cross lines and different plants are called the same name.
Yeah.
And then you could end up in trouble if, you know.
Or more than one common name. Or,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, often that's the case too.
Yeah. So, and I have to ask this question, bananas. Can you really grow bananas here?
There's a banana tree at the visiting center when you come in from California.
Yeah.
Is there?
I don't know if it produces bananas or if it's there year-round.
Usually just the vegetation here.
Oh.
I don't think you get enough heat. And that, I got that question from somebody here who moved from Florida. they were asking about growing tomatoes here in the winter, and I said, I don't think so. Even in the best greenhouse with the best sun situation, you just don't get enough heat units. Mm-hmm. To grow a lot of things. And that's part of our issue is because we're, you know, we're at a fairly high latitude. So, I mean, you know, it's not outrageous at all.
We get a lot of light, but we don't get the warmth that is necessary.
Both. Yeah. But you get pretty fair light here. But the heat for things like cantaloupe and watermelon, all, unless you're living up a river valley and you're really soaking in the sun somewhere, they're hard to grow.
Hmm.
Peppers, those kind of things. And you can use greenhouses, but yeah, especially viney stuff, it's kind of impractical. It takes
and
a lot of room.
It is kind of amazing that you don't have to go very far upriver to encounter a different climate altogether, or for that matter, altitude. You're 1,100 feet up.
Yeah.
I live 1,100 feet up, and I never know how to dress. I know now if I'm coming to have a jacket that I keep in the car, and I can just put that on, because sometimes it's 80 degrees on my porch, and it's 55 degrees in town.
Yeah,
sure.
And something that I've always thought of as an invasive species, but I don't think that it is. And this question comes out of with the Azalea Park issue. They're trying to keep the azaleas alive. And one of the things that I noticed, first of all, growing azaleas in Oklahoma is extremely difficult because it's hot and it's dry. So they require a lot of water, but azaleas don't swim either, it's hard to maintain that balance. But we have an azalea park in Muskogee, and I grew them around the house. And what I found about azaleas is that if a little blade of anybody's grass came up and touched the azalea would yield. And what I see at Azalea Park, the azaleas there are all covered with this, and trees. They're covered with some sort of a little green fuzz, a lichen.
Yeah, lichen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that in fact retarding the azalea growth?
I'd say very little.
Very little?
Yeah. That's one thing that people often worry way too much about is lichen, and you'll see it on fruit trees as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even on just growing flat on the bark, algae moss, some, you know, those things aren't too much of a problem. I guess what I'd say is some of it too, I think, has to do with the age of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the problem with Azalea Park is a lot of those branches. There was a guy named Red Cavender who came down here,
mm-hmm.
and he spent a lot of time, and he opened it up to the community to talk to them about azaleas, and part of the reason they were having problems there, you know, the different things
yeah.
that he saw that were happening. And again, fire. I mean, we don't like talking about it, but it's often a natural, ongoing natural event, and because those haven't really been touched by fire, they're just overgrown and plus I think some of them in shadier conditions also helped add to them being leggy, you know, and so there's some different things going on. Not sure how the soil plays into that as well, but
right,
you know, and just the conditions overall that they're growing in. That's why Master Gardeners took on trying to refurbish those, especially those that were more toward the ocean, which would have been the south side, I guess, of the park
mm-hmm.
there. And we were trying to cut back a lot of the old growth and promote, you know, the newer stuff,
mm-hmm.
kind of get refreshing, getting new growth on those so that they'd be healthier plants.
I've heard more than one person comment that the best thing that could happen for the azaleas there would be for somebody to come with a blowtorch and just take them right down to the ground. There was one there that we were looking at that they chopped it down for some reason, and it was just a bunch of little sticks kind of sticking out of the ground.
Right.
And that was turning into a nice azalea bush.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Because that was the point of what we were trying to do.
So maybe the thing to do is just come along with one of those saws and just take it down and say good luck.
Yeah. If you have these at your house and if you have shrubs at your house, one of the things that you might, and this is a good time, probably a good time of the year to do it. Although there's certain plants like forsythia, for example, that you would want to wait on mm-hmm. after they flower. And then cut them after they bloom, cut the wood after mm-hmm. they're done. Same thing probably with rhodies and azaleas to cut back. Prune, you'd wait till, you know, after you got the flower. That's probably the best time. Being said, you could do that. You could do it almost any time of year. And a lot of those plants, what you want to do, especially with the old growth, older branches, is thin it out. Take mm-hmm. out those older ones and then let the new ones come up. And you can always thin out some of the newer ones too if it's too thick.
Okay. Which, speaking of azaleas and rhodies, it seems to me the 2 years that I've been here, they bloom twice a year.
I think you can get double blooms a lot of times on certain plants.
Is that because we're just cooler? Is it just the right combination of light and temperature that's fooling it into thinking it's springtime?
Oh, that's interesting. I can't say that, but I would think some plants just seem to have. And I think a lot of it has to do with the climate.
Hmm.
They seem to have two blooms, but they usually have the heavier bloom in the spring, usually.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a lighter bloom this time of the year. I had some primrose. I couldn't believe it. They were in containers, and they bloomed their heads off this autumn. Hmm. I did not expect that at all. Mm-hmm. And the deer ate them, too, which was kind of a drag. But anyhow, I moved them closer to the house. But anyhow, there's another example of something that isn't deer-proof. It's interesting. You know, a lot of it has to do with, you know, how much water probably they're getting to and mm-hmm. how we're caring for them.
Hmm. So what do you do about deer? When I moved here, I told the real estate agent I didn't want to live in a subdivision because I lived in a billion acres in Alaska. And he took me around and showed me houses in a subdivision where they had more land, like almost right in town, and there'd be deer and turkey and everything in the driveways, and and I'm a wildlife photographer, I said, this is going to be great. Then we found a house that was out of town a little bit and actually in the forest with a billion acres behind us, and we hardly ever have deer on the property. And Dan lives in a gated subdivision and feeds them by hand, and I've never even seen a track on my property.
Huh.
But
Well, that's because they're coming into town because it's easy living. You know?
People, they don't want to be
cut. Actually, it's interesting you'd say that. That because there is probably such a wide variety of really more succulent kind of plants, maybe? I don't know. But they've just acclimated to people too.
So. Where I am, they're wild, and they don't. Yeah. I've had one on my morning walk. I've been running into for a few days in a row now. She's getting very used to me. I talk to her, and she waits a little while before she walks off. And now she walks off; she's gonna run away. So, but how do you keep them off your plants? We were told if we planted fruit trees, we would have to have 6-foot fences around them. And
yeah, if you're starting out with small fruit trees, you definitely want to protect them.
Okay. They eat the tree or just...
Oh, yeah. Especially the branches are small. They'll nibble them right back. Or, you know, they can break them by pulling on the foliage, especially when they're small. I mean, and if you have elk, forget it. I mean, unless you're planning on really putting up something substantial to protect your fruit trees. Which brings in probably the number one way is to fence your land. I mean, if you're going to really not want to have deer there, you're going to want a deer fence. That's going
to
be the number.
That has to be huge, doesn't it?
What's that?
That has to be very
high. Yeah, usually about 8 feet.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, some people would want to do it. They'd consider it an eyesore or just too much money.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of time and effort if you're going to do it yourself.
8-foot fence.
Yeah. Do you have a dog?
No.
That would probably be almost as good. Dogs we had a dog and... We lived up the river for several years on top of a hill 1,500 feet high, and we were out of town quite a ways. And we had issues with wildlife and kind of loved it because it was great to have the wildlife around. But our dog really, just by marking and walking with us certain places, kept...
That may be why we had a dog. My dog just died the other day, but we had one, and I always thought that's probably the reason we didn't get as much wildlife.
I bet
she loved raccoons. Raccoons would come on the deck and just tease her.
Yeah,
but
yeah, raccoons can be a real problem. You might just see how things go now, because if the dog's not around, you may end up getting deer visiting again.
Yeah.
So if you want to protect the trees, can you buy a can of spray doggy pee and just...
That kind of thing is such a temporary fix.
Mm.
And especially if it's near your house, then you might have to live with the odor, especially that rotten egg stuff. I've never used it. And I know some people do, but I don't think I've heard anyone swear by it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say, you know, in the end, it could be kind of an expensive fix. I know people have talked about milk and all sorts of different things and making their own. Go ahead and try it. I mean, you know, if you can find evidence that it's useful, you might give it a shot and see. And often what happens too is people will employ different ways and, you know, kind of change things up so they aren't doing the same thing all the time. It's kind of like with birds in the orchard too. If you have those spinning CDs catching the sun or whatever, it might scare them away for a while, but then they'll get used to it probably, and they'll be kind of an issue.
I lived in Alaska for many years before I moved here, and the problem there was with moose. If a moose finds your garden, they don't just nibble a little lettuce, the whole garden leaves with them. But there again, they're wild animals, and they have to realize that lettuce is food for a moose. You know, they don't naturally know that. You know, it's like a baby horse doesn't realize a carrot is food. You almost have to stuff it in their mouth until they taste it. So,
well, and you know, it's interesting that what deer will come to can change. It depends, I think, on the season, on the other vegetation that's available, on maybe even their individual taste. I mean, I had artichokes outside a fence for over a year and they were totally fine. And then it came to a place where, you know, they were chewed. I mean, they were eaten. And, you know, then so I moved some rhubarb out in its place, and I moved the artichokes inside my fence, kind of my deer fence that I had, and then they were fine. So I mean, you know, it can change what they'll eat, and sometimes they'll eat things you wouldn't expect, and sometimes you get lucky. But you know, I think part of it is also, where are you in terms of their food, their path, and where they go for you know, and again, animals play a big part in that. I wanted to say something else about the dog, because I think it was fascinating. We had real issues when we were away for several years from our place with bear. And and bears have learned over time to scratch the tree bark, and you know, they get the sap, lick the sap or whatever. That's
and they're also they're marking too.
Yeah, and it could be that too. But what was interesting was we never had issues when we had a dog around. So that was something else, especially if you lived out in the Tules and bears might be an issue. That's something else where it was an advantage to have a dog. And that was just one dog we had.
I would walk with my dog every morning, and the first time we walked into a bear, she came running back to me. She was afraid of the bear and brought the bear with her, of course. And then the bear saw me, it ran away. And the second time, it was in the bushes, and she was barking and barking and barking at it. And I kept saying, it's okay, it's okay, it's not going to bother you. And I kept walking towards it, and she kept trying to stop me. Said, are you crazy? And then the third time we saw one, it saw me about the same time it saw the dog, and it started to run away, and the dog chased it. And she was so proud of herself that she could chase a bear, but we never did see another one, huh?
Yeah, it's easy to do when you see it's already running.
Yeah. Yes, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, maybe the dog figured that one out too.
Exactly.
I want credit for this.
Okay, invasive species. No, I want to talk about monarch.
There.
I want to talk about monarch butterflies and milkweed.
Oh, good, because I have that as one of my questions.
Okay, I want to do this, and I can't really plant anything. I own the house and the footprint of ground that the house sits on, but the rest of it belongs to the homeowners association. And I don't think that they would. Although milkweed really is an attractive plant when it flowers, I think.
Yeah, but try to be sure, and this would be something you can search online, that you're getting a native type.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and there, my supervisor I work with at OSU also has concerns that it is poisonous to cattle or to grazing animals. So
that's why ranchers don't want it.
Yeah, probably. And, you know, again, they probably wouldn't eat it unless they were really hungry, but if they did, it could be bad results.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... You know, it's just another thing to consider if you're planting it. People often grow it in their greenhouses, or they get seedlings or seeds. And the people to contact for that, we're not the ones. Not that we can't help you find the right type. But you'd want to contact, just go to Facebook and go to their Monarch page here. I mean, they really share a lot of information.
Dennis Triglia is a kind of our lead person on Monarchs.
Yeah, Dennis Triglia will come in and talk with you guys, or Vicky Meon, or there's a couple other folks associated with it. That
he's been in that seat more than once.
Yeah, I figured he might have been. Yeah.
So, but the Monarchs are, is this that, well, I guess my first question is, milkweed does grow here, I guess, because people are growing it here.
Yeah, definitely certain types. Yeah.
Even though we have this...
Probably most types would.
Probably a little cooler because of the ocean. And I don't know if salt air is really real or not, but it seems to me that there's an entirely different class of plants that grow along the ocean as opposed to those that like grow where you are. I mean, the blackberries will grow anywhere. But and I do want to talk about blackberries some more because I never considered blackberry to be... I have to share this. I ran across a YouTube in Scotland, and this guy said, okay, this is a blackberry, and a lot of people don't consider this to be really a dangerous plant, but when you stop and think about it, it really is a carnivorous plant. It said the barbs face in, and then he walks up to a lamb that is caught, or actually it was a pretty good-sized sheep that was caught in the blackberries. And he said, if I don't come and free these animals from these plants, what happens is that they can't get away. And so they wind up starving to death, and they die right there, and their remains are beneficial to the plant because they fertilize the plant, et cetera.
And that's kind of a far-reaching carnivorous plant definition,
really
I would say.
Well, yeah, it is. But nonetheless, I mean, yeah. I see his point, and I think it's very valid about blackberries. And I don't think they're swallowing bears in this part of the world. But let's go back to the milkweed for a minute, because now this is something that grows naturally pretty much nationwide, I guess. And... grows where ranchers are eradicating it because, as you say, it's hazardous to the cattle they're trying to raise. I can't see it growing in the sandy soil over there close to the beach. So it, at some point, does it become invasive or anything like that, or is it just all natural for here and there's no worry about it?
Well, there's natural, if you go up the rivers, I don't think we really had it right on the coast.
Yeah,
inland okay. a little ways, yeah. So I think it probably that probably indicates that it would prefer heat.
So that leads me to believe that the flyway for the monarchs is probably a little more inland, and that's the problem, is that they're encountering people who are trying to get rid of the milkweed, and they're getting rid of the monarch butterflies also in the process of that.
Yeah, I know that there's, I'm quite sure, I don't want to say a no, but I'm quite sure that there's a kind of a path, maybe the what you're mm-hmm. talking about, where they winter, overwinter in somewhere on the coastal California.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some that don't make it all the way to Mexico. I think we're talking mostly okay. the inland, way inland would be the ones that fly to Mexico. I don't know if ones from the Northwest would or not. They could, but mm-hmm. I think they probably overwinter in California.
Yeah, because I'm amazed at how many bugs I don't see here in this part of the world. I mean, in Oklahoma, they're everywhere. We have all these nasty things, mosquitoes, chiggers, ticks.
Yeah, you guys do have a lot of nasty
Yeah, we have a lot of those.
And, well, we have ticks here.
Huh?
We have ticks here.
We have ticks here?
Yeah, there's not a lot of them, but I've had a couple of ticks on me since I've been here, and the dog had some.
Yeah.
But we don't really have much of a problem here with things eating our rhododendrons or azaleas or anything. Slugs, I guess, get into gardens, but...
Yeah, there's a few insects that key in on that, like there's a root weevil that can be hard on roadies, but generally they're pretty... problem-free.
And then there's kind of an orange and black, I guess you'd call it a caterpillar, I don't know. The first year we moved here, they were everywhere. The ground was covered with them, and now I'm just starting to see a few.
The woolly bear?
No. These are almost hairless, and I assume they're a larva of some kind of a critter.
Yeah.
They're like a type of millipede, possibly, even. I don't know. You're not familiar with
most caterpillars that I've seen will become moths.
Yeah,
you know, of some type. Some that would be seen as detrimental, and some that wouldn't.
There's a little beetle that's a very similar colors, and I assume that's what it turns into. I don't know, but they don't. Somebody told me that they eat rotting vegetation, which I guess would make them good.
Are you talking about millipedes, centipedes?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, generally that's
reprocess it and make it even more valuable, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, there's one that people see, and I just don't know what to tell you about it. It's really an interesting. I think it's millipede, and it's the shiny black one with the edges that are yellow or orange.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, I think it's in the fall, but also in the spring. It seems like I've seen it different times of year, where it's like these mass suicides.
Maybe the animal we're talking about.
Mass die-off, yeah. And then and they just all of a sudden come from nowhere, and there's just whole bunches of these things. People really freak out about them, and I don't think that they really do any damage.
And nothing eats them because, from what we've read, they contain cyanide.
I think that might be part of what is released when you – if you pick one up
pick
in your
up,
hand.
Pick it up, you can smell it, yeah.
Yeah, and it's got a really unique odor, kind of sweet smelling. It's really weird, but I don't – and, you know, so I don't think I've ever heard that they bite or anything, but they are, you know, probably want to wash your hands after you pick one
up. Or not eat them.
Yeah, definitely not eat them.
Probably resist that.
Yeah. But people ask what to do about them. And honestly, I think that they like, kind of breaking down organic materials. And so if you have a lot of that around your house, you might be attracting them, but it's hard to know.
They're just kind of walking all over the place.
Yeah, and then they're gone.
Usually they're gone almost
as quickly as they arrive. Within a week,
I have an interesting story from Oklahoma. I was out walking in the woods one day, and I wear hats, and it started to rain. And then I realized it wasn't raining. No, it was caterpillars. They were dropping out of the trees like rain. I mean, you know, there were hundreds, thousands of them that were just falling out of the trees under the ground. And I never understood why or anything, but
I wonder if they were
weird.
Getting ready to pupate, and that was the quick way. I don't know.
Yeah, to get from up there to down there, just drop. Yeah.
That's interesting, huh?
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about my own personal plants at home, one of them being a plant that I'm kind of fond of at this point, the nasturtium.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does it grow, is it native to here?
No. No, I'm quite sure it's not.
Okay.
But it does really well here. It does really well.
And I see it growing wild in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And I like them, and so do the deer. And so
they can be used in salads.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, the flowers and the leaves. They're kind of a peppery taste.
Oh, well, then I'm not interested.
But it's probably like, you know, pepper your salad. Don't put a lot in.
Yeah.
It's got a unique flavor.
Yeah. So anyway, I had a bunch growing around the house, and when I bought the house, the inspector guy said, don't let them grow up around the house because they get up underneath the siding and then you've got problems.
Yeah. They do.
So, but I like them. And so I dug some up and I've managed to transplant them into pots. And I noticed they were in three different colors. So I dug up a yellow one and I dug up a pretty deep orange, almost red, and another one that's kind of just a golden yellow orangey kind of like that. And so far they're maintaining these colors. They're not changing colors for whatever
I think
reason.
Individually they'll stay the color they are, but how that's determined would just be by, you know, their breeding, their seeding.
You haven't tried cross-pollinating to see if you could get some multicolored ones? Or
I'm going to have to study them. I've been picking up the little seeds and poking them down in the soil because I'm not sure how they propagate. So I figured if I put some seeds in there, that's got to be one way. They're easy to grow. Okay. Well, that's what I need, are plants that are easy to grow. And other one.
And before you say about the next one, I really want to make a point of what you said about siding. Because I had a couple, and they were very happy where they were growing. And this was an old farmhouse, which I joked about, said it was melting into the earth anyhow. But, I mean, they were growing up the side of that house and into the siding. I mean, they were pushing their way. And you look at these plants, and they look almost like, they look soft. They look almost like rubbery. I mean, but not like they would have the strength to infiltrate like that. But do not plant them next to the house unless you want them there on an old building or, you know, old garage or something. Then maybe that's fine. But no, those things can be a real menace, which blew me away.
Yeah.
I was surprised.
I think they're really pretty. I like them. Go ahead.
Were you done? I have a listener.
Well, I have another question, but go ahead.
Oh, I have a listener question.
Oh, you have a listener question.
Yes. Uh-oh.
That was emailed before this started, and I'm just going to read this phonetically because I have no idea what she's talking about. Let's see. Is there a detailed plant growing zone map for the area? If not, is there a growing zone chart according to elevation? I can read the question again if you'd like.
No, there's kind of more than one question there.
Yes, two questions.
Yeah, because the elevation, depending what your latitude is, you know, and rainfall and all that, those are going to really, and your how much you freeze in the winter, those are going to be totally, that's a wide open question.
Okay, now, I think what she's looking for is a map or some type of a chart that she refer to in growing.
Yeah, there's a USDA one, I think, that goes from zones 1 to 10. I think we're in 9. We're a very mild climate zone. And then there's another one.
But the climate down here where we are now, where I live at 1,100 feet, can be quite different. It snows where I am, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah, but even then, I mean, unless it stays on the ground.
No, it's gone by coffee.
Yeah, I lived at a higher elevation, and I'd say it was barely different than Gold Beach. In fact, we could probably grow more up there. It was milder in a lot of ways, or we didn't get that cold northwest wind that we get in Gold Beach. So, you know, I think we actually were able to grow more. So it was, I'd say, almost a warmer climate, even though we did get snow. We get snowed in usually like once a year.
Uh-huh.
There's also another map that they could look at that I think is still used by Sunset Plant Guide manual.
Right.
And I think it goes from 1 to 17, I think that one actually goes to 24 or something. But anyhow, it goes everything from like the coldest spot on the top of the mountain to, you know, Hawaii. So, I mean, it's just, it has all of these different, I mean, even within split zones, it'll be like 17A and 17B. And one has like cold pockets of, has to do with like, you know, fog pockets or whatever. And another one might be being on the side of the hill, or maybe something with you know, some amount of clouds it might have to do with, or just the location with air movement, all those kind of things. So it's, that's another one that's probably more specific in some ways and might be more useful as far as more zones that are listed. But, and there's probably others that are used too that I've either seen or can't remember or just not aware of.
I want to talk about my begonia.
Go ahead.
Once upon a time, I had some kind of a begonia, and it was a magic plant.
Was that ruby begonia?
Huh?
Was that ruby begonia? Never mind. Old joke.
Okay.
You're not familiar with Sammy Davis,
I don't know what kind of a begonia it was, but at any rate, I swear it was growing in water, and I'm so far successfully growing a begonia clipping that I got from a friend in water. And but I had, it was a big pot, and the begonia was so big and huge, and every year I came along with the shears and just cut tons of it off and threw it away. And every now and then somebody would say, can I get a clipping of that? And I'd say, oh, you bet, you know, and I'd hand them one. But I love this plant, except for that it flowered these little itty bitty flowers and it made a mess
it's
on the floor.
It's more the leaves probably.
Yeah, it's the leaves.
Yeah.
But I swear to God, there was no dirt in the pot, that it was all just growing in water. So is that a hydroponic? Is that what you would call that? And is that...
Well, you're going to need some sort of mineral or nutrient base for true hydroponics. Again, I don't know. The plant wants to live.
It's growing.
Yeah. So some plants you can root out like that.
It did. And I just took a little stick and I put it in a glass of water it sprouted roots. And then I put a bunch of gravel. I tried this with a previous clipping and I went to the beach and I got a bunch of gravel and I put it in the pot and they just died. Yeah. And I figured that's because the rocks from the beach have a lot of salt in them.
Yeah, it could be.
So I went upstream, up the Chetco River, up to Loeb Park, and I got a bunch of rocks from there. So far, so good.
Okay, then that probably had something to do with it.
Yeah.
Don't know for sure, but a lot of things can be started. What you're doing is you're starting with something by a cutting.
Mm-hmm.
And begonias are really interesting because you can actually slit the leaf, and I can't tell you how to do it. I'm trying to remember. It's just leaf cutting? Anyhow, you can... They're one of the few that will actually, you can put the leaf in and it'll, you know, slit it and pot it a certain way and it'll actually produce a new plant from that where you cut it.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying it both ways would be interesting. I know I was told I have a tuberous begonia that I love, just beautiful. Mm-hmm. So I took a couple cuttings just about a week ago and I thought, I hope I'm not too late on these because someone read that you could actually do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a tuberous begonia, which is probably different than the type you had. But what they do is they die back every year, and then, you know, you bring them out the next year. I put it in my garage in the dark the whole winter. And then, you know, once the temps pick up and it gets warmer, and it's a beautiful, beautiful, huge begonia, but I pot it up each year. So it's getting more and more soil.
So you put soil in it. I've been putting that...
You'll need eventually.
That
you're
plant
gonna
food stuff, but
well, oh, okay.
I should
so,
probably get something a little better for it than that, right?
That may be why it's performing for you like it is. Yeah, it's going to need a substrate of some sort, I would think.
Okay.
Eventually. So, can I talk about the Master Gardener program?
Yes,
now?
Please.
Yes.
But, yeah, we only have 30 seconds
playing,
left.
We have been playing the information you sent me.
Oh, I
yeah,
really
we did
really,
a recording of it the next day, and it's been playing quite a bit.
Yeah, that's great. I really appreciate you doing that. So for all those folks listening out there, what Ray's talking about is there's an announcement that we've been running for the upcoming Master Gardener training, which begins January 11th and runs till March 15th. And it runs, it's a class that takes place every Friday from 9 until 4, and we have an hour lunch break, and we also have a couple other breaks where either our master gardeners or we each bring, you know, a few snacks to have available so that we, you know, don't get too hungry with all that we're learning and all the work our brain's doing every day that we take this course. It is a loaded course. There's so much information. We have faculty coming from OSU as well as other exchange agents. We have our extension agents. We also have a couple other folks who are real aficionados, is that the right word, on certain topics on landscaping here on the coast as well as growing veggies here on the coast. And then we also provide information as to how to determine, you know, if your plant has diseases and kind of what it might be and how to figure that out. Because one of the things we do after the course is over, everyone is asked to volunteer, because that's how we do really provide outreach mm-hmm. in the county. And I'll tell you a little bit more about what that involves in a second. But we run the course weekly, and we really, like I said, it's for, you know, trying to establish our volunteer support and base for outreach. And there's all sorts of different topics that we cover: soils, pruning, fruits, small fruits, fruit trees. And people are invited to attend. It's $20 per session if you want to just come and sit in on one. And it's a three-hour session.
And where is this again?
This is up at the Extension Building at the fairgrounds in Gold Beach.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the cost for the course is $175, which may sound a little bit steep, but it is it really is a full college course.
Yeah.
And there's so much to glean, so much to learn, that you just really get started. It really is the basics on a lot of things, and I think well communicated by the presenters in a way that, you know, you can grasp and really hopefully make use of.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do is, after the course is over, those folks who went through the training are asked, and as well as the people who've been part of our program for a long time and stay on and support, is to provide outreach to the community. And that could be in the form of plant clinics up in Gold Beach. It could be information tables here. We recently had a table at the Monarch Festival event. It could be, you know, at the Azalea Festival. We're there in the building with, you know, where they have the plant sale and the flower show and all that. Mm-hmm. We also do the same thing at the Curry County Fair. We always try to answer people's gardening and plant questions and issues that they might have, you know, in Gold Beach, or a few people sometimes will answer it. If I ask for some assistance, if they have an area of interest, they'll try to get the question to them. We also work with kids and try to provide support in the schools. And, you know, we have a garden. We're going to try to run a seed to supper program this year, which will involve especially inviting people who might, you know, have issues income-wise to grow with some of their own food. And we're working with the church, Living Waters Church, mm-hmm. and the minister there to make that go. And we, you know, we try to provide education events. We have a library series that we run every year on all sorts of different topics that we've been running now for several years in a row at the library here in Brookings, and then after school programs for kids. So we do have a lot of outreach that we provide, and we look for people, you know, to also let us know what they're interested in so that we can meet their needs.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And the clock says we're just about
out of time.
Yeah, 10,
okay.
9, 8.
Well, wait, before we close out, we got to give a thank you shout out to our recording technician, Pi White.
Uh-oh.
He also gets to edit, and he was shaking his head, and he probably edit this out.
Now his name's on the air, and the secret is out.
Is out, yes.
Thank you, Pi.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, thank you very much for coming. I think that was great.
Yeah.
That was really very informative.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.